Welcome to an Earth Day special on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM Blue Hill, and WERU.org, on which we will be talking about land conservation trusts in Maine. My name is Matt Murphy. I'll be your host for the next hour. I'll introduce my guests in a moment, but first I'll note that we are broadcasting over unceded Wabanaki territory, where Wabanaki peoples have taken great care of the land for thousands of years and continue to do so today. And now my guests on the program, all from organizations right within WERU's service area. George Fields, Executive Director, Blue Hill Heritage Trust in Blue Hill. And in the interest of full disclosure, WERU is a tenant of Blue Hill Heritage Trust on the tower on top of Blue Hill Mountain that they manage is where we broadcast from. Julia Zell, Executive Director of Island Heritage Trust on Deer Isle. Landon Fake, Executive Director, Great Pond Mountain Conservation Trust, headquartered in Bucksport and covering a number of towns. And Siona Ulbrich, Associate Director of Partnerships, Maine Coast Heritage Trust, talking to us from their Mount Desert office. All right, welcome, folks, to the program.
Thanks, Matt.
So
great to be here.
Yes, it's great to have you. And why don't we go around, and if each of you could say just a little bit about your organization by way of introduction for those who may not know about you, and then we'll dive into a bunch of questions and comments and conversation. So, Siona, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Thanks. So I'm a longtime staff member with an organization called Maine Coast Heritage Trust, which is a statewide conservation organization. And we also have a program called the Maine Land Trust Network, which may be of interest to listeners because a lot of people don't know that there are over 80 land trusts around Maine doing this voluntary conservation work around the state. So our network sort of brings those land trusts together and disperses resources and publications for all. And meanwhile, our organization also does a variety of conservation and restoration work up and down the state, really, and lots of fun projects with other organizations.
Okay, thank you. Julia from Deer Isle.
Thanks, Matt. Happy to be here. I'm Julia Zell, and the day this airs is actually my six-year anniversary of working with Island Heritage Trust. Started on Earth Day. It was a fun happenstance. We are headquartered in Sunset in Deer Isle, but we cover everything from Agamaugen Reach down in the Stonington Deer Isle Archipelago. And our focus for land conservation is primarily islands, so certainly on Deer Isle, but also the offshore islands, of which there are many. And really education, scientific study, and then also access to the shore, particularly for the traditions of clamming and fishing, were a big part of the our articles of incorporation, for example, the reason our reason for being. And so that's a big part of our focus.
Okay, thank you. Landon, how about you?
Sure. Thanks, Matt. Great Pond Trust started really in about 1993, like a lot of land trusts with a bunch of people around a kitchen table focused on the threat of, potential threat of a local landmark being developed. In this case, it was Great Pond Mountain. It wasn't until 2005 that the land trust actually acquired Great Pond Mountain and about 4,000 acres around it. But still was a really small organization. I was hired in 2019, and I was the first full-time staff person. Now we're up to two full-timers and a couple of part-time people. And we've increased the size of what we call the wildlands, about 1,000 acres since then. We're a little different in that our main focus is our one big preserve. And we have a couple other properties, but really it's about the wildlands.
All right. And, okay, thank you.
That's good.
George in Blue Hill.
Hi, I'm George Fields. I'm a freshly minted executive director with Blue Hill Heritage Trust. I've been with the trust for over 11 years in other capacities. I'm pleased to help lead this organization, for the next 10 years or so. Who knows? So don't hold me to that. I'm getting up there in age. But we serve eight communities across the peninsula, everything south of Route 1 to from Castine to the west side of the Union River in Ellsworth. We partner a lot with Island Heritage Trust and MCHT. We have a total of eight people strong in the office, and we've conserved just over 12,600 acres between conservation easements and owned property by the trust.
Okay. Well, thank you all for being here to talk about your work and help celebrate Earth Day. First, could any of you say a few words about the conservation movement, land trust conservation movement in general, whether it's in Maine or around the country or how it all got started? What is this whole business about land trust conservation?
I'll take a first crack at that. That's a big question, but I'm going to suggest that conservation, if you think about it as care of place, care of land and water, actually started thousands of years ago with Wabanaki people who care for the land still today. In more recent times, in our country and legal system, there are these organizations called land trusts, which really started mostly back in the 1950s and 60s in Maine, more in the 70s and 80s, so a few decades old now. And land trusts are really a way to work closely with landowners of all types, so private people, corporations, towns, state parks. We all work to either create agreements or place restrictions on land to think about shaping its future uses, or we own and manage lands generally for people to come and enjoy, come and do research on, come and be on or connect with as open, usually undeveloped properties. So often with trails or for hunting. Water access, all those different uses. So that's my start. Let's see who can build on that.
Yeah, who else would like to take a crack at that one? Julia.
Yeah, I think that was so well said, Sayona. One of the things that strikes me as well when I was first starting to work with land trusts and getting to know what they were, I'll admit I didn't really know they existed. I definitely took the resources and services that land trusts provide for granted, particularly when I first moved to Deer Isle. I was not, or first came to Deer Isle over a decade ago, really didn't understand the resources that were there and that the work that goes behind it, which I think we'll talk about today. But I think one of the interesting things I've learned since then is how different it manifests in different places. So Sayona mentioned there's over 80 land trusts in Maine. And if you look at other states, there's a myriad of reasons for this, but some states are similar and have a lot of small localized land trusts as well as some bigger ones, but other states don't. Other states might just have one or two that cover huge regions or the entire state. And one of the things that I think that's really interesting about private land conservation model and the way that it works here in Maine is it feels very aligned with this feeling that we have in our communities of especially the disperseness or, the spread out nature and rural nature of many of these communities is that they have the ability to have a say in the work that gets done in their community. And so, say you had one big land trust that might be headquartered in the one big metropolitan area of a state, and if they were making decisions for up in the county, do they is that really the best model? It can work, of course, but I think it's been really amazing to see how it works in Maine, and it seems to really work pretty well that we each get to, and here are three small ones that are a stone's throw from each other, but have actually vastly different focus areas that are representative of the differences in our communities. And we collaborate a lot too, because there are obviously similarities and we're all doing the same good work. But I think that that's an interesting factor to the land trust movement as well. And it's true, Blue Hill, I think, started in 85. IHT was 87. Landon just mentioned the Great Pond was 93. MCHT was before that, 70s, or yeah. Anyway, but
1970.
1970, so much earlier. But it's really it's an interesting history to learn, and I keep learning more. And of course, it is certainly very much rooted in our current system that is, I don't know the right way to put it, Sona, but I continue to learn more too about how we have come in and conserved some of these beautiful places in the way our systems are built, but that really had been stewarded by the Wabanaki people, or for First Nation people, for a long time before that. Learning that the hawthorn was planted there on purpose, and they used the pointy barbs as fish hooks, and that was intentional. And who knew at Scott's Landing, for example. And so continuing to learn more every day.
Thank you. George or Landon? Yeah, Landon, go ahead.
I just add a little about maybe what land trusts are up against and the importance of land trusts, particularly in Maine. Maine loses about, well, between 10 and 20,000 acres of forest and farmland every year to development. So really, land trusts are a lot about protecting at least what was traditionally the Maine landscape. And it's as the land gets more fragmented, more smaller and smaller pieces sold off, our work gets more difficult, but it also is more important in protecting big chunks of landscape where there's enough room for biodiversity to work and for kind of the mosaic of species that exist in Maine to live and thrive there. So it's so they're important and urgent in that sense. But also land trusts have become kind of the main vehicle for recreation, outdoor recreation in the state. Land trusts manage more acres of land. They manage more miles of trails. They own and manage more water access points than all of the government organizations together, municipal, state, and federal. So if someone's out recreating, odds are they're on a land trust's property.
Great, thank you. George, do you have anything to add, or should I move into my next line of questioning?
A little small piece. I think I will tag on with Julia. What I find incredible, over the last 40 years for just Blue Hill Heritage Trust and other small land trusts, the fact that, we all started small, potentially over a kitchen table. And just that momentum has grown to what it is today. And it's, there are just talented people across the state that are, conserving land for wildlife habitat, for scenic, for historic purposes. And it's phenomenal to see what we have done, in just, 50 years now, 55 years with MCHT taking the lead.
Great. Well, Landon, you touched upon this. My next question is about challenges and what are the hardest, most difficult parts of your work? We'll get into the happy parts in a little bit, but I thought we'd go right to the challenges that are most vexing in your work. And whoever would like to go first?
The challenges. I guess I'll try and start with some thoughts, and then we can build. There are lots of challenges. That's what keeps it interesting. I'll name two that I think we all share. One is cost. Real estate is getting more and more valuable, as we all know, whether you're trying to find a home or whether you're trying to buy a property for conservation. The costs are not going down, and finding ways to fund that is an ongoing challenge. And I think a second, something that hasn't yet been brought up in this work, but is fundamental to the success of land trust work, is people, landowners, who are willing to sell or willing to gift, or however, working with you on agreement restrictions that shape conservation into the future, willing people who care, who want to, who are willing to give the time, give the funds, be a part of conservation. We're so fortunate to have a lot of them around, and that is fundamental to the success of voluntary conservation work. And though it's not all people, and so sometimes you can't get that one property that's so important to people because there isn't a willing seller or a willing person to turn it over. So sometimes people get in the way, even though they're also foundational to the success of the work.
Great. Thank you, Sayana.
I piggyback off that and say that I think right out of what you were just saying, Siona, is I think one of those challenges I've really felt, and I alluded to this already, is misconceptions, misunderstandings, or just not a lack of awareness. Nobody's fault necessarily, but just a lack of understanding about what we do, how we do it, how it happens. I've heard things like, "Well, why don't you just buy that? You guys are rich." Or to some of my staff coming back to me and saying they met with the contractor who was, helping us mow our fields to maintain the meadow, and they were like, "Well, you guys don't have to work. You're all volunteers, right?" Assuming that these young people, or middle-aged or older, but that they just don't have to work, and that we're not, that we're all volunteer, which we used to be, of course. But anyway, it's I would just say that misconceptions, misunderstandings about how we do what we do, what we do, who it's for, why. I mean, obviously that's a challenge for anybody, but I think very much related to what you just said, Siona, I think that that's a big piece of that.
Thanks, Julia. Other challenges and difficult parts of the work.
Yeah,
I think
I'd say, go
go ahead,
ahead.
Leland.
One is stewardship, and just maintaining the land. You know, once you get to the end of a long project and you finally acquired something, then you have to take care of it. And sometimes that's a significant burden. The Wildlands, for example, has 30 miles of aging gravel roads and 180 some culverts, most of them rusty and not functioning very well. So it's just that the responsibilities that come with land ownership are a big chunk of our budget. And like others have said, it's hard work sometimes getting the word out about what it is we do and how we operate. You know, we face criticism sometimes about not paying taxes, which largely is not really the case. We pay taxes on all our land, or you know, the tying up land that could be developed and could be contributing to a tax base. We face those questions pretty regularly.
Thanks, George.
I think I was just going to add on that, at least the hardest thing I concur with Landon is just the stewardship aspect. We are protecting these properties in perpetuity. And, along with that comes with just a need and a recognition that, we have to live up to our end of the bargain as well. People entrusted us to protect this land and to steward it in a favorable way. And it's difficult, to one, find funding for that. It's not a sexy job. It's not like, you're buying a new piece of property. It's down in the dirt and getting dirty and making things, not really perfect, but as well as you can for folks to enjoy the property.
Right, thank you. Yeah, it's the work is important, but it's not easy, is what I'm hearing. There's plenty of challenges, but those challenges keep things interesting too. It came up a little bit, the issue of money. fundraising and money to buy the land, that the cost of land is going up. And can each of you talk a little bit about the how money factors into your organization in terms of your fundraising and what you have to do to bring the finances to bear to do the work?
Do you want
I
me to
guess
start?
I can jump in, Niona, since you've done so. I think the biggest thing is, for one thing, we can only pay up to a point that's called appraised value. We have certified or a qualified appraiser to do properties. And oftentimes the appraised value lags behind fair market value in different economies. And we have, we can't pay for, top dollar fair market value for a property typically. So what we have to do is have a motivated seller who's interested in conservation and be able to find grants or, conservation folks that are willing to donate, to help purchase said properties. So it's all about making connections with both sellers and then funders, or donors. So being able to have that, not really in your back pocket, but being able to ask folks for money when you need money. It's not like you're going out to a piggy bank and, emptying that every time something new and exciting comes along. You have to plan, and sometimes it takes years for a willing seller to say, okay, I'm ready to, sell the property to you. So it's a challenge, but it's exciting all at the same time.
Thanks, George.
And it takes that takes capacity, right? So I remember when I first started actually speaking with you, Siona, about adding capacity to IHT, which we've done. We're up to seven, not full time year round, but seven folks, which is huge for us. And really, a lot of that stewardship, it's care of the land that we already have, taking good care of what we have been entrusted with, has been a critical part of that. But the other side, and Siona's recommendation to me was, you can't even consider all the things that George just said about looking ahead and trying to be proactive about conservation projects or even responding to them if they come to you if you don't have the capacity to do so. And it's a really interesting specialized skill set and takes a great deal of time and relationship building and something that I continue to learn all the time. And not every trust is necessarily always trying to go out and add more and more, but and that's not necessarily the goal forever, but it is an important piece of what we are doing. And I just would say that, again, coming to money, it's not even just the purchase of the land. It's do you have the and volunteers did it for a long time and can still, and there are places in the state where there is success with small land trusts that are entirely volunteer being proactive about new conservation projects, not to say there aren't, but it really, you have to have a dedicated volunteer with a specific skill set and a lot of time to give to make it successful. And that's a huge, and even if you don't have a volunteer, then you have to pay a qualified professional, a living wage to do that work. And it is really important. I'd say that that's as much a big part of the cost of land conservation as well.
For small organizations, and I know you know this, Matt. Well, in my case, the executive director, I have responsibilities, equally around protecting land, doing land deals, as well as fundraising, and donor relationships. And on the one hand, it makes my job really interesting, but it also sometimes makes it hard to plan the day.
Yeah, and I'll maybe end with maybe a direct response, Matt, to your question, which is really, I think, about how the money works. And I think So you've heard a lot about the need for private support for capacity and ongoing staff work, the hard work on the ground that land trusts do all around Maine. And we are fortunate to have people who support that around Maine and foundations. And that is how a lot of the work keeps going. Each of us are ra raising funds every year to keep going. On top of that, a lot of the projects we do, whether it's acquisition of land or whether it's restoration projects or whether it's even some of the taking care of land, we will often collaborate on grant writing. So all of us here have worked together in different ways and partnerships on various projects. And Julia spoke to it before, but one of the real successes in Maine is our ability to collaborate really well. And we have been really successful, even right here in this peninsula, Blue Hill Peninsula, that is, around bringing in federal funds and state funds for projects in, by local trusts and or by our trust as well. Thanks to our ability to get along and collaborate and work together to get projects done. So.
Okay, great. Well, on that note, I'm going to take a quick break to let folks know that you're listening to WERU Community Radio and an Earth Day special about land conservation organizations in Maine and their work. Once again, my guests are George Fields from Blue Hill Heritage Trust, Julia Zell from Island Heritage Trust, Landon Fake from Great Pond Mountain Conservation Trust, and Siona Ulbrich of the Maine Coast Heritage Trust. And once again, thank you folks for being on the program and sharing some really great insights with us. My next question is about what are the best parts? What's the most rewarding thing that you're experiencing these days or have experienced through your work, whether it's a feel good, warm, fuzzy story or just some other aspect of how this nourishes you and how this is rewarding work.
Well, for me, this is George. For me, it is every summer having young interns come into the office and have our group of staff mentor and teach them and just, show them around for, 10 to 12 weeks on what a small land trust can do and let them see the various stages, from development work to stewardship and forestry to administrative work. And get them excited because oftentimes this is their first job. And we developed an intern program 9 years ago and named it after our original executive director. And that program has brought in 22 fresh young faces over the course of that time that are still in conservation work. And every summer, for 12 weeks, I'm on cloud high. That is what I truly love about the land trust community and what's, they're going to be the new donors and philanthropists and doers, as, we retire and move on to other things. So it instills in my heart just a certain pride that, I had and my team have had a part in nurturing these young folks down the line.
Great, thank you. Who's next?
I'll chime in. This is really Siona's topic, but I'll get her started. Well, this could be in also in the category of what's really difficult, but Land Trust has started really reckoning with the history of land conservation and working with the Wabanaki. All of us, all of our land trusts are kind of, in on ground zero for Wabanaki lands in terms of what lands were part lands that are part of Wabanaki homelands that were really important to them. And there's really been a big change in land trust in the last few years in trying to figure out how to have relationships with the tribes, how to grant access to preserves, how to give land back to tribes, and whether it's around land justice or around just good ways to do conservation. I think the relationships with tribes is becoming very important and will be more important. But it's still difficult, complicated work.
You want me to go say, I know my, I was gonna say something. I agree, Landon. And we are, I would say we're at the beginning of this journey. We have a board member and a staff member participating in First Light, which is a learning journey, with the Wabanaki Commission. And I really should let Siona talk to this too, because I'm not the staff member who's doing it. It's our conservation director, but he mentioned that someone shared a metaphor of this process, which is, say you're walking anywhere, could be out to a point to a lookout or just in the woods, and at some point you decided to turn around and come back. And so everything we've done with or to the Wabanaki people, we've have been going out, and maybe we've actually stopped and turned around, but either way, wherever we are in the journey, however far out you've walked, when you turn around, you have to take that same time and distance to come back in the other direction. And anyway, so I feel like for me certainly personally, and our trust, we're at the beginning of this process, and it's so much bigger than us, but it is, it's an honor and rewarding. And I don't mean to make that about me or us, but it is, something that feels very important, and I'm glad we're doing it. The thing I was actually going to say, and it kind of quickly just touch on the collaborative nature too, Siona, that we talked about, and this is sort of also your story, not really, but a board member of ours at the time, who subsequently became a board member of MCHT, lives on Deer Isle, and MCHT helped IHT at the time do the Scott's Landing project, which is at the top of Deer Isle, very important project. And actually, George, lots of folks have been a part of this, and really, I'm getting this as an important story from our history, where that was a big $1 million project at the time and really important to the community and fundraising, and MCHT is helping, and it's got its ups and downs, but it's looking like it's going to be successful. And Jean, the a board member at the time who lives nearby, was helping collect donations, and a local family came to her, and the family's daughter gave her like $20 or something. She'd saved up her allowance for weeks. And she said, "Oh, I wanted to deliver this to you. This is towards the Scott's Landing project." And then they asked, "Well, what's going to happen now? Are we still going to be able to visit the beach?" And she said, "When this is done, it's going to be in trust for you, for the public, for generations. So you and your kids and their kids and their kids will get to enjoy this place." And that is really, I think it's really stuck with me, clearly. That was, you know, 20 years before my time, but it really, it matters. And I don't know who that person now, but they're probably an adult, and their kids get to enjoy it, and so on and so on. So that's, definitely feels like one of the most rewarding parts of what we get to do.
Yeah, I love that story. And that's, I think, where I was going to go, Matt, with your question, which is, I think probably the reason that I've been at this work for as long as I have been is that I love that feeling of helping a group of people who really care a lot about something, a place, being able to find a way to help them, make it theirs. Turn it into a place that they and future generations can keep coming to and think of as their special place, is one of the most rewarding feelings. And I think that, you know, there are many hard days and boring days, as with any job in this work, but that feeling of helping a place stay the way it is and helping a group of people figure out a way with their energy to make something good happen is really one of the most wonderful rewards.
Yeah, sounds like it. Sounds like it. Well, having walked on trails that you folks are all involved with. I thank you for all that great work. It's really, you do an awful lot for the community. So we were, I can speak for myself, but I think others really appreciate all the work that you put in to have these nice stories and nice situations for people out in the community. Everyone has their story. If you bump into someone on top of Great Pond Mountain in the summer, they have a story about how they found, oh, I never heard about this place before. I've been coming to Maine and now I found it and this is great, and same thing happens to all of our land. So that leads into a question of how do you reach out to people? How do you get them to know about you and about the work that your organizations are doing?
This is such an interesting question. We actually we had a meeting the other day with some folks, some marketing folks from Visit Maine or the the Maine Tourism Board, and they actually came to meet with us because of something the town of Stonington was doing, which is great. So again, rising tide lifts all boats. We work together with lots of different organizations and each other, and it's all great. But one of the interesting things that I'll maybe pose the question to my fellow folks here is, of course, we do want and we need to get the word out, and we do lots of different types of outreach, I'm sure. But something that came up was, what is the balance of care? And so we intentionally keep some of our parking areas small to hopefully limit traffic at that preserve at any given time, both for user visitor experience, but also impact on the environment. Also, we hear some folks on Deer Isle and Stonington say, oh no, we don't want to become Bar Harbor. Don't tell everyone about us. And while that can have many implications, it's just that's something you hear. And so how do we balance this? Because we do want to get the word out and we do want people to know what we're doing. And we obviously need support, particularly financially, but also with people. But at the same time, we're protecting something fragile and important, and there's it's an interesting balance. So I guess I'm not really quite answering you, but I'm sort of posing that to my peers here because it's a that's a something that we have to consider each time we make a decision or take a step in terms of doing outreach.
Well, you get moderator points for improving my question, so that's good.
Sorry,
So,
Matt.
oh, very good. Excellent. Excellent. Anybody want to tackle Julia's question?
I'd just add a little bit. Yeah, we have the same conversations. One of our trailheads is right on Route One, and whatever it is, 2 million cars every summer go past on their way to MDI, and we think, well, do we want a piece of that traffic or not? And what do we get out of it other than full parking lots and more feet on the trails? I think we've been really trying to focus our outreach efforts more locally, and be a more local resource as in terms of providing opportunities for outdoor recreation, outdoor education. But it is hard. I think we're all, it feels like sometimes we're doing this bait and switch thing. We want people to support us, donate to us, help us with the land trust work. But the way you reach those people is to get them out on the land, out on the trails, to go on top of Great Pond Mountain and see the view. And it's usually after those experiences that people understand what land trusts are about and what they can provide, and then they become supporters. Yeah, I'd just say it's a ongoing conversation.
Yeah, it seems like there's a balancing act that you all have to do, because there's places that you manage that in the summer the parking lot is full, and so local people know I'm going to wait till September to do this, or I'm going to get up really early and beat everyone there. maybe not to the extent of Acadia National Park, but some of the parking spots at trailheads get filled up pretty quickly in the summertime.
Yeah, that's the truth. I think I might add a little, Matt, in thinking. I'm thinking about some of those delicate, sensitive areas that we've also brought up. Another focus of conservation work is like seabird nesting islands. We work closely with the National Wildlife Refuge to sort of make sure that Maine, which is on an international flyway of birds that are, flying long, long distances, they need these islands in order to stop and roost and feed up and rest before they keep going on their huge flight, their migration. And we don't think about that, but that's also a role of land trusts, is to help some of those really delicate habitat areas also be kept from change. And that sometimes means closing things off to people. Ideally, we have to put a sign up sometimes and say, "Don't come here, there's an eagle nest," or "Don't come here, there's seabird nests. Please respect that." And that's also part of our job. We've become known for a lot of recreation possibilities, I think, especially through COVID, when people needed to get outside and discovered all the trails around here because they needed places to go. That really increased recreational use quite a lot. And there's more that we do, and a lot, and some of those areas of really delicate habitat are also a focus of our work. We often are having to lean on grant funding to try and do that kind of work because it's hard to convince people to support that. They can't use it or see it. So it gets back to that money question too. And we've brought up today a number of times the concept of balance. And I think that's really what this comes down to, is balancing, finding those supporters, building the support to keep yourself at scale and to manage and care for those properties, and doing some of that work that's not so exciting, but so important to the bigger picture.
And you're accountable to both people and animals and plants, and there's a lot to juggle, a lot to balance. Yeah. George, you were going to say something.
Yeah, as Siona alluded to, that not every property that we conserve is meant for a trail. Let's save a good portion of properties for wildlife habitat, for the trees to grow, to protect those sensitive environments. And we have, over the years, have started looking at, just conserve the property for the property itself. So
Great. Ken, in the time we have left, I'd like to give each of you an opportunity to talk about the what you've got coming up that you want people to know about, whether it's to know about to make a donation or know about to help come and do some work or to help come and learn. What do you have going on? And we'll start with you, Siona.
okay. I'll name a few things that I can think of. One, on Earth Day, we have an event down in Portland with in the Space Theater, where there are a number of authors of new environmental books who are going to be talking in terms of that kind of outreach event. We were just talking about events. But I'll name another couple closer to home. So I'm excited about Penobscot Alewife Day, which is May 24th from 11 to 2 at Pierce Pond in Penobscot, where we usually have 300, 400 people come through in fish print t-shirts and learn about alewife and learn about pond life. And a number of the organizations here will be there that day with tables. So come check that out. And we have a volunteer cleanup day at the Seal Pond Fishway on Mount Desert Island on April 26th in the morning, where we ask volunteer help to try and clean up a fishway that fish will be running up and down in the spring. So I'll name those.
All right, thank you. Julia, what have you got coming up?
We do a lot of programming. We've got one of our big, probably our biggest one each year. Will be at Alewife Day. As Sona mentioned, we also do an annual birding festival, although it's a bit more than that. called Wings, Waves, and Woods. It's been going on for well over a decade now. It's a bit expanded this year. That's May 14th through 18th, and it's a whole bunch of events. Information's on our website. People can drop in and do as much or as little as they'd like. And it also goes to your point about being on the international flyway. It's a really, and this is migration time, folks. So pretty excited about that. That's a big push we're working on right now. We've also got some other projects going on that we're excited to announce soon. We're continuing to do the work. So come in and visit us.
Thanks. Landon.
Kind of on the organizational level, we just closed on a 70-acre piece of land that abuts the wildlands last month. So we're kind of figuring out how to add that into the mix of things. We're working with Maine Farmland Trust and Frenchman Bay Conservancy on a bunch of different projects trying to extend the wildlands to the east to into Ellsworth. And those are exciting projects that you'll be hearing more about. And then kind of on the outreach side, we have a speaker series on May 7th. A forester named Ethan Tapper is coming. That's a program that Blue Hill is sponsoring with us, as well as Maine woodland owners. Ethan Tapper's a really interesting guy. The best way to understand what he's about is to look at his Instagram feed. But we do a monthly speaker, and like everyone else, all that stuff's on our website.
Okay, thanks. George from Blue Hill Heritage Trust, what do you have coming up?
We have a couple of things going on. Later this month, on the 19th, we have a Carter Nature Preserve cleanup, and that is from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. I don't think you need to register for that, but check our website if you can at bluehillheritagetrust.org. And then on Saturday, May 3rd, we have a well-known landscape interpretationist, Tom Wessels, who lives now in Blue Hill. He will be doing a walk on one of our trails between 9 and 11 o'clock. That one does require some registration. So again, see our website for that. And then in July, we are celebrating our 40th anniversary with a community celebration at Wooden Boat from 4:30 to 8:30 at night, at night. And it is an event where you have to purchase tickets for it. A whopping $40 will get you a fun-filled evening of barbecue, some live music, and just to hang out at Wooden Boat near the shore. You can't beat it. So, but check out our website to see how you can get tickets through Eventbrite. So those are the biggies for us, in the next couple months.
So lots of exciting stuff. So
Matt, can I add one more event that I forgot about?
absolutely.
May 3rd, we have Calf Unveiling Day at Aldermere Farm in Rockport, which is a chance to see the cutest little fuzzy Oreo cookie cow calves on their sort of day out. And being introduced. It's a working farm we own down there, and it's a pretty great family day.
All right.
Great. Now, we may have to change our, May 3rd date with Tom Wessels then, because everybody's going to flock down, down south. So great. Thanks, Iona.
Can't beat cute animals.
Yeah.
No.
So, W.C. Fields said, "Don't work with children and animals." So
Right.
they will upstage you.
That's right.
So if we could just go around one more time and final comments that any of you may have for our listeners, some things that you want them to take away in particular. And we've been starting with you, Siona, so we might as well keep going.
Okay. I'll try and sound smart. I think I would say a thank you to all the landowners and supporters of land trusts around the state, who do make this work possible. Because without those little collections of lunch money or those significant grants or the being willing to give the time or the lower price to make this work possible, without that, none of us can do this work. So I'll start with that. A big thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Siona Olbrich from Maine Coast Heritage Trust. And let's go to you next, Julia Zell, Island Heritage Trust.
Thanks, Matt. And Sayona, I second that. And maybe even to loop it back again to something we said earlier, I think you said it, Sayona. I just encourage and invite folks to, in these sometimes challenging days and times, and certainly in a life, a modern society with a lot of technology and screens and busy schedules, that you prioritize time to get outside and appreciate this place anywhere, wherever you are, even if you're not in Maine. Really appreciate place and get outside and breathe fresh air and welcome spring.
All right, thank you. Landon Fake, Great Pond Trust.
Yeah, I guess I'd just say thank you as well. Thank you to the people of Maine who I think really understand and appreciate conservation in a way that maybe they don't in other places as much. I think conservation and land trusts are really a community endeavor. So I have to say thank you too to Julia and George and Siona, and all my land trust colleagues, because we do work together on projects, and that community aspect of it makes it feel really worthwhile.
Thank you. And finally, on to you, George. George Fields from Blue Hill Heritage Trust.
Well, Matt, thanks for this program. It's been great. My participants that have joined me, thank you very much. I am a newbie at this position, so I'm still learning from all of you. The one takeaway that I have is this is all about community. We do this work to build community and embrace it. And I've been here for 20 years, and I just, this is home, and I love doing stuff here for those within my home.
All right. Well, thank you all for sharing all this information and insights and all your good work. I want to thank you for being on the program, and thanks everyone for tuning in and listening on this Earth Day, and for your support, all the listeners out there in WERU Community Radio Land. My name is Matt Murphy, your host, and have a happy Earth Day, and we'll finish out listening to Jonathan Edwards' This Island Earth.
Calling all dreamers and optimistic fools, don't let go of your dreams. Make it now, make it all come true. If you believe in a brighter day, I know we can find our way to this island in the starry ocean. Poetry in this island earth, spinning like a dancer. Gravity is the answer. Rendezvous in the blue. This island earth. Well, I don't know what's in store today. We could spread our wings and we could soar away. Or we could go like the dinosaurs, they say. The choice is ours to make. But it always seems like this to me. We could wake up one day and be history, or stick around to unravel the mystery of how we came to be. On this island, in the starry ocean, poetry in motion.
nation, this island Earth, a beautiful oasis for all human races, the only home that we know, this island Earth. Well, I know we can touch the stars someday and kick up the dust on Mars one day, or trip the light on the Milky Way. We've got to find our way. And if you're looking for a miracle, open your eyes. There was one this morning, just about sunrise. Dawn came breaking like a wave on the sea. It's there for you and me. Oh, calling all dreamers and optimistic fools. Don't let go of your dreams. Make it now, make it all come true. If you believe in a brighter day, I know we can find our way. This island Earth, spinning like a dancer, gravity is the answer, rendezvous in the blue, this island Earth, rendezvous with the moon, rendezvous with the moon, this island Earth, the only home that we know. This island.